This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
I'm Candace Lim.
And I'm Rachel Hampton. We're the hosts of ICYMI, Slate's podcast about internet culture.
And we want to help you make sense of the need-to-know internet stories of the week.
Consider us your internet historians of past, present, and future.
Of the good, the bad, and the truly unhinged.
From nuanced takes on stories we're all closely following, to the ones you wished you heard about.
In case you missed it, that's ICYMI, the podcast that's extremely online, so you don't have to be. Follow and listen now.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Okay, I'm not going to explain now, but just hear me out. Listen to this.
Strap in.
This is BBC Radio 4.
I remember hearing this and I was like, whew, hold on for dear life.
UK station of the year.
I'm coming out.
We're going to interrupt you because Chris Mason has news.
The Prime Minister has agreed to stand down.
A year to remember.
What the hell just happened?
With powerful documentaries.
They say at the heart of every conspiracy theory, there's a kernel of truth.
Hard-hitting interviews.
How did you survive, Natalie?
I think it was my faith.
And innovative entertainment.
Screaming, like pushing hard and then...
This is Ad to Playlist on BBC Radio.
Okay,
Are you listening?
Winner of UK Station of the Year.
My castaway this week is the singer and songwriter...
Hear it on BBC Sounds.
Is this genuinely paranormal?
BBC Brief Lectures in a series...
This... is BBC Radio 4.
Here at Woman's Hour and to you at home.
The thing is, when I saw him there, I just said, you've got a hell of a job, the best of luck. And what I really wanted to say...
Don't tempt me.
Hello, this is Nuala McGovern and you're listening to the Woman's Hour podcast. That loophole allowing retailers to give free vape samples to children, it's set to be closed. These are under government plans. They want to curb the use of vapes among young people. But it is just one part of the story of vapes and their popularity. So we're going to be speaking to a professor of public health about just how concerned you should be about the health effects, and also to a mum whose daughter was addicted to vaping. So that's coming up in just a couple of minutes. Looking back... tonight. Succession. Are you a fan? Are you a super fan? Well, I am. I've been unwaveringly committed for a long time now. And just as The Sopranos before it, I'm really only interested in the women in that show. This time, instead of Carmela, I'm smitten with Shiv. That is Siobhan. Just one of the many fantastic female characters that played a role in the dynastic, dysfunctional family and friends of Logan Roy. So we're going to get into those characters this hour as well. I also want your thoughts on the following. Some of you already getting in touch on this. Because many of you listening will know that having big breasts can be a pain, and in more ways than one. So it could be back or neck stiffness. It could be bra strap, groove, indentations. They can be physically challenging. But there can also be a lot of unwanted sexual attention, and harassment, for example. So we're going to hear in particular about the rise in women paying for breast reduction surgery privately. We'll talk about the reasons that they're doing it. And it's often, did you know, to the tune of about £9,000. So we're going to take a look at that and also at the place of breasts in our cultural history. So to get in touch, like Jill did, she's already got in touch. She's 63 and has had a breast reduction surgery 6 months ago. You can text the programme 84844. On social media, we're at BBC Woman's Hour, or you can email us through our website. And indeed, for WhatsApp or a voice note, that number is 03700 100 444. Also today, childcare. You might know that the UK is one of the most expensive countries in the world for childcare. But if you have kids and you want to work outside the home, is it worth going into debt to pay for it? Maybe you're hoping your career will progress and maybe your salary with that. Well, we're going to hear from two women who took that path, but now have differing opinions on whether it's in fact the way to go. So stay with us for all of those conversations that are coming up. But let me begin. With vaping, just to tell you again that the government, they've announced they're set to close. They call it an unacceptable loophole, which allows e-cigarettes to be given away to teenagers, while also looking into the rules around the sale of nicotine-free products to under 18s. You might have seen that the Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, has said he's worried about the colourful marketing and also the risk posed to his two own daughters who are aged 10 and 12. We do know that research by NHS Digital shows that one in five 15-year-old girls use electronic cigarettes, 7 percentage points higher than boys of the same age. And in a moment, I'll speak to a parent whose daughter was addicted to vaping, and also to a head teacher who's trying to get control of vaping in his school. But first, let's listen to Linda Bald. She's Professor of Public Health at Edinburgh University, an expert in this field. And I asked her if vapes are dangerous.
They're not safe. They're not risk-free. I think we can look at absolute and relative risk. So relative risk, the comparison is always going to be smoking. Mm-hmm. And in that case, vaping is significantly less harmful than smoking. And we know that from multiple studies, both in humans and in the lab. But that's just because smoking is so uniquely harmful. In absolute terms, of course, vapes have risks, and the risks that we're aware of are related to several components. The first thing is nicotine, which in itself is not harmful to health. We prescribe it to pregnant women who smoke, to people with cardiovascular conditions in the form of nicotine replacement therapy. But it is addictive. So it's the nicotine, which means you want to use the product and you keep using it. And you can have nicotine withdrawal, which for a young person can be very disruptive. They're craving their vape. They can't concentrate. They feel agitated and worried. Very bad news in education or work settings. In terms of other constituents, there are toxicants and carcinogens in vaping products, in the e-liquid and the vapor, at lower levels than in smoking, but not zero. And chronic exposure over a long period would result in some health harms from that.
Definitely.
Well, we actually just don't have decades of data. We do know that some of the constituents are respiratory irritants. And we have seen young people who've had lung health effects from vaping. Small numbers, but if you do that over many years, you know, there may well be COPD or even lung cancer risk, again, at a very low level. We just don't know that. It's better to be safe than to be sorry.
And with COPD, that's chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. And forgive me because I was interrupting you there, but you were saying lungs and also...
So lungs, there may be other, the cardiovascular system, for example, might be affected by some of the constituents in vaping. We see that in some lab-based studies. Again, we just don't have the longer-term data. So the bottom line for us is, what we want is for smokers to quit. For them, vaping is a good option. But for people who've never smoked, including teenagers, why expose yourself to something that may have unknown risks in the future?
Well, I suppose putting my head into that perhaps of a teenager is maybe because it's something kind of cool to do, or is it has the appearance of being cool for certain people? So how do you stop that?
Young people try loads of things. You know, I'm the mum of, well, they're in their early 20s now. One of them is. But, you know, we all get that. It's absolutely right. And we were all like that in our youth. You know, young people are drinking. They're trying different things, of course. So they're going to try vaping. When you look at the surveys of teenagers, the number one reason for vaping is to give it a try. And then some people like the flavors, their friends are doing it. But I think the challenge for us in the UK is that these products are widely available. They're incredibly cheap and they are marketed. And of course, those things, in addition to just trying stuff, are going to enhance the appeal.
Is there a gender angle to this? I was reading that it appears to be teenage girls that are picking up an e-cigarette at a faster rate than boys.
We're seeing more experimentation in girls, but when you look at regular use, it's a bit more like smoking. It tends to be a little bit higher in young men. Mm-hmm. And in fact, in terms of vaping in teenagers generally, only about 25-26% of regular vapers are never smokers. The most of them are teens who already smoke. But when you get to the experimentation category, where there's a lot of young women, young girls, over around two-thirds of those are never smokers, the ones giving it a try. So we need to be careful.
Let's also talk about regulated and unregulated vapes. What's happening there and what's the difference?
So we introduced a regulatory framework in 2016, which actually is pretty comprehensive, but there are loopholes. And with any regulation and any age-restricted product, some irresponsible manufacturers and retailers want to get around it. So we've got an illicit trade. It's not huge, but it's there. There was a high-profile story recently about lead, nickel, and chromium mm-hmm. being found in vapes. The problem with age-restricted products, whether it be other things that kids are not supposed to buy, you don't actually know what you're using. And if you get that product from a friend or somebody else buys it for you, it could be anything. And so therefore, illicit trade is a concern. And you need different measures to try and address that, including through customs, border force, but also, as we've heard announced today, giving trading standards additional support and powers to make sure that they're getting on top of that trade.
Because what the news was today is that, in fact, those free samples, there's this loophole that children basically can be given free samples because they're not selling them to people that are underage. So they're trying to close that loophole. Do you think that will really help?
I think that's a pretty minor measure. But just to explain it, the reason why the free sample kind of exemption is there is because in the early days of vapes, again, we were trying to get smokers to use them. So the idea of a smoker wandering into a vape shop and being able to try, great. But unfortunately, you know, the chickens have come home to roost. So that's a minor measure. I think more support for trading standards. So in terms of where young people buy a vape, the most common venue is a corner shop, a newsagent. So we need to take some action on that.
You have said, though, that you don't think they should be banned. And I know you have laid out that we don't know the full extent of how harmful they are, but you have outlined quite a few. Why is that not the way to go? Because, you know, do young kids ever need to pick up a vape?
Well, let's think about the market. So there's a category of products, disposable vapes. I won't name the brand names. Everybody sees them thrown in the street now. That's what young people are using. 68% of young people are using a disposable compared to 7% in 2021. So the market has been fundamentally transformed by this category. I think we need to increase the price of that category quite significantly. Price is a major deterrent to young people. You can buy one of these for $1.99. I think there's something fundamentally wrong with that. The broader category of vaping products, you know, the tanks, the things that smokers use to try and quit, I don't think that we should ban those because I've been doing the trials and I know they work for smokers. So it is about trying to be nimble and strike a balance. Let's not have prohibition because that has other consequences, but let's get the regulatory framework stronger and more nuanced than it currently is.
Professor Bald there, and she spoke about the trading standards. Well, Kate Pike is the lead officer for vaping at the professional organisation, the Chartered Trading Standards Institute. She spoke to the Today programme and welcomed the government's plan, but said changes to the colourful packaging should also be considered.
How can we make these products less attractive to children? And there's a call for evidence open at the moment, and we're hoping that many people will be submitting ideas to that call for evidence to enable products to become less attractive to children. For example, we need to be looking at the packaging. We need to be looking at the positioning of these products in store. We need to be looking at the promotion, particularly on social media, and how to ensure that children aren't attracted to these products just to give it a go, which is the main concern at the moment.
Which we were hearing particularly with girls, right, from Professor Bald. Well, the numbers of young teenagers who smoke tobacco cigarettes instead has hit a record low. Fewer than 12% of secondary school students haven't ever smoked a cigarette in 2021. But in place, the number of young teenagers vaping is at a record high. I want to bring in two people who know a lot about vaping among teens. One is Leanne Maguire, the mother of a teenage daughter who was addicted to vaping when she was 15. Good morning, Leanne.
Morning.
And we also have Rob Pavey, who is the head teacher at Cheney School, a secondary school in Oxford. Welcome, Rob.
Good morning.
You know, I'm just seeing already 84844 people getting in touch on vaping, and I'll get into some of the comments in just a moment. But Leanne, I want to start with you. Tell us what happened to your daughter. I said she was addicted to vaping at 15.
Yeah, well, that was her words to me. So that was last year. She turned 16 in January, and as part of my voluntary role, I sit on a citywide committee in Glasgow, and this is something that we've spoken about for a couple of years now, about vaping. So I was quite surprised when my daughter, well, first of all, I caught her out. Mm-hmm. It was clearly being hidden. Thankfully, I was in a fortunate position that I know what these... what the disposable vapes look like. I knew what to look out for, etc. And I suspected and I found out.
Can I stop you for 1 second and forgive me for jumping up? What do they look like for those parents that don't know?
Yeah, so that's a good point. They look like highlighters, really. I mean, if you saw them sitting on your child's desk at home, you probably wouldn't blink an eyelid. You would come in and walk past and just think it's a highlighter. Mm-hmm. A lot of these small disposable ones are so easy to conceal. And actually, I mean, when I eventually did search my daughter's room after finding this out and having a chat with her, and she said she was addicted, I found over 15 like hidden within her room because they are so small they can be easily concealed. So yeah, I was quite taken aback when she said, when we found out that she was vaping. And this is where our group has tried to campaign for more education for young people and parents, because the two things that my daughter said to me was, one, there's no nicotine in them. That was the very first thing, which I nearly fell off my chair when she said that. And then two, she turned around and says to me that she was addicted to them. It's the habit of lifting them up, sucking on them. She felt that they eased her signs of anxiety. So straight away, that was really concerning to me.
And what about that point that Professor Bald brought up, that girls are more likely to experiment? What do you think about that?
I mean, I think certainly the reports that I've heard, again, this is not from my daughter, but through my group, the reports I've heard is that some young girls are using them as an appetite suppressant. Mm. Some of them are using the colours to match their outfits. So I suppose I can see why that would maybe be more attractive to young girls, where they're maybe matching them with nail polish and outfits, and it's like a bit of a trend. But certainly I don't think we need to lean back and think this is more of an issue with young girls. I think it's an issue with young teens and young children. I mean, in Glasgow, we're hearing reports as young as primary five, so that's around 10 years old.
Okay.
Vaping. So I think it goes straight back to that marketing point that Linda brought up, and I know that a lot of the vape companies hate it when we bring it back to that point, but the fact is, what grown man or adult is sucking on a blueberry, raspberry, ripple vape that's bright pink? Very few, I'm sure.
I'll go 84844 if you are that person. Get in touch. But, you know, you bring up so much that I want to ask you. How did your daughter obviously admitted to it, said she was addicted. And how did she stop then? Is it any different to stopping smoking, do you think, which many of us will have had experience personally or off a loved one doing it?
It's very difficult. So, I mean, at the moment I'm saying that she has stopped, but I say that with quite trepidation because at the moment she's on study leave. So she's not at school. She's out doing her volunteering. So she's not around that peer group that are entirely doing it. We had periods from last October until now where she would stop. And then the minute she was kind of back into her peer group, she would start again. Now, we did, on a regular visit to the GP about something else, I did ask my GP, what do we do in this situation? If she's saying she's addicted to it, how do I get her off it? What's the alternative, etc.? And the GP turned around and said, there is no alternative because vapes are seen as an alternative to tobacco smoking. There's no alternative to vape smoking. So I think, again, that's the challenge that you're up against as a parent, is that how do you get your child out of this vicious circle where they're okay when they're at home, they can maybe step away from it, they can listen to you, they understand, don't go near it. But then the minute they're back in that peer group and everybody around about them is doing it, a 15-year-old is not going to have the self-control that some adults have. And that's the challenge as a parent that you're up against. It's almost like fighting a losing battle.
I want to turn to you, Rob. We've heard Leanne and her daughter's story. How much of a problem do you think it is?
Well, it's certainly a problem. The difficulty is, of course, it's much less visible, or you can't smell it as much, rather more to the point. With cigarettes, you can detect it either as a parent or as a teacher, because you can smell it on clothes, you can smell it in buildings. But vapes, you know, there's a certain kind of fruity aroma, but is that just the air freshener or is that a vape? It's much harder to detect. And like Leanne said, they're very, very small and they do look like highlighters.
I was just looking up actually before I came to speak to you, you know, can you detect electronic cigarettes or vapes? And there are some systems, right, that hotels can have that will detect it, that's different from a smoke alarm. Do you have them in schools?
So we don't. I've heard of some schools that have installed them, and we're considering trialling a couple in a couple of locations. I don't know, to be honest, how well they work, because after all, it's water vapor, and I don't quite know how sensitive they need to be or how effective they are. But we're considering trialling one in the sixth form toilets, it has to be said.
Oh, it's always the sixth form toilets, isn't it? Time immemorial, where everything goes down. But when it comes to the issues, I think that Leanne was outlining for her daughter, is it something that kids have come to their teachers about, worried about addiction to vaping or worried about using them?
No, not much, not yet. We've had a sort of a halcyon few years where the cigarette smoking has dropped off a cliff. There's almost none of it that comes to light in school. And now vape smoking is picking up. I don't think there's yet the concern that there probably should be, either with parents or with teenagers, about the possible harms it's doing. So we're not seeing yet many people coming forward. We do find them, either that drop out of people's bags or when we have cause to check someone's bag, we do find them and we do take, you know, appropriate action at that point, including informing parents.
But well, do you get detention or anything? Is there?
Well, I mean, the first thing is telling mum and dad. That's the main thing. And we have a very effective thing of an hour's worth of public health information with Mrs. Conway. That's extremely effective at deterring almost everything, plus detentions as necessary. And if someone is trying to sell them, which we have found someone recently doing that, then we have suspended a couple of people for that.
But that is. So sorry to interrupt you. I'm just seeing so many comments coming in. Let's go through some of them together. I'm a secondary school teacher and worried about the widespread use of vapes by teens. Our parents, this is a question, are parents regularly searching bags so schools don't have to? The sweet flavours dupe parents into thinking their kids have a new body spray. It's naive or neglectful of parents not to investigate. Leanne, of course, talked about going through the bags, and you talked, Rob, only going through them if it's necessary, really looking for something else, I think I detected.
Yeah, absolutely. We wouldn't want to be in a position where we're doing regular routine searches. That's very heavy-handed. We're not a police state. We're a school. But I think this conversation is very important, because it is when parents and schools are saying the same thing, and when there's sensible, appropriate action, as your first speaker said, from trading standards and so on, then we can get on top of this. I mean, this is... You know, teenagers don't have a great track record for listening to what their teachers say on things like this. But when parents and schools and official action on things like the marketing, and like Leanne says, strawberry, blueberry, bubblegum nonsense, is that really aimed at adults? Then it can be reduced.
There's another comment coming in relation to that, Rob and Leanne. Just ban the disposable ones and only make the other type available by prescription. The disposable ones are so obviously designed to attract kids, bright colours like pens, sweet flavours. It's blatant profiteering. Grown-ups, government, just admit it and act now, not in a few months or next year. Get real. Another one, also angry, do officials really think that vapes are a device to stop smoking? It's a new product entirely. If it's a medical product, it should be sold to chemists. So kind of come to the prescription angle again. Any research into how many users vape who have never smoked? I know my first guest has been looking at that, and there are high numbers. It has ended up being a product used by people that it wasn't intentionally, well, that some say it wasn't intentionally designed for. I need to couch my words there. But that does bring up, of course, the government actions today talking about closing that loophole. Would you like to see it go further, Leanne?
Yeah, I mean, certainly in Scotland we now have, I think we're sitting at 22 councils have called on Scottish Government for a ban on disposable e-cigarettes. Because what we need to, we're kind of, I know the main point of conversation just now is youth vaping, but the disposables have a really detrimental impact on our environment. Mm. There are pets choking on them in out of parks. There are young toddlers that we're getting reports of at our group picking them up in parks and sucking on them. So there's a number of risks involved in particularly disposable vapes, and yes, I would like to see it go further.
Here's another one, and you alluded to this as well, Leanne. This is from Kate. She says, as a mother of a 14-year-old boy who claimed to be addicted to vaping, it's important to recognise that another reason young people may continue to use vapes after the first experimental experience is that they believe it can alleviate anxiety. The motivations then shift from the initial wanting to be cool or enjoy the flavour and colourful packaging. My son has now quit after a period of gradually reducing usage over a number of months. It's an interesting one. You mentioned it already, Leanne. Let me go back to you, Rob. I mean, what about anxiety in teenagers and vaping? Is that something that teachers are talking about?
I can see how that works. I can see that there's a lot of sense in that, yes. I'm not sure it's come up as a prime motivator, but I can definitely see how some teens, particularly with exams coming up and so on and so forth, and various other social anxieties and social media and so on that we're all familiar with, I can see how that would fit. It's not surfaced as the main reason yet. I do think, like Leanne said, the peer pressure thing and the attractive packaging and so on and so forth is much more of a factor at the minute.
Really interesting that they continue to come in. One more from Michelle. It seems to be like the same problem we had previously with so-called Alco Pops. Lots of sugary sweet concoctions designed to appeal to youngsters. I can't recall they were banned, but they seem to disappear after a while. Yeah, it might be worth following up on that. Rob and Leanne, thank you both so much for speaking to us this morning about vaping, as indeed the government intends to close that loophole that was giving out free vapes to children.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Lots of you getting in touch on my next topic as well. Big boobs. Have you got them? Do you like them? Love them? Hate them? Well, they have been part of our cultural landscape, particularly in certain eras, I think, and certain celebrities, I think it's fair to say. I'm thinking of like Barbara Windsor, maybe in the Carry On films, or Sam Fox, remember her, and Page Three Girls in the 1980s. Then Katie Price or the Kardashians in later years. But big breasts, if you have them, you'll know they don't usually come without some issues. At times, that might be physical, neck or shoulder pain, for example, or it might be societal, others treating you differently because of the size of your chest. Our next guest is a writer and podcaster. Jackie Adedeji has spent much of her career promoting positive attitudes towards women's bodies, as well as exploring people's relationships with their breasts on her podcast, Boob Share. And in her new Channel 4 Untold documentary, My Big Boobs, Jackie takes a look at the negative impacts that big boobs can have on your life, and also those navigating breast reduction surgery, and chatting as well to women who just love their boobs and, you know, talk about those reasons. Well, we're also joined by Sarah Dightem to discuss the cultural history of breasts and their place in society. You're both so welcome.
Thank you for having us.
Already, as I go down the comments that are coming in, I'm so struck by some of the issues coming in. I had mentioned one lady who got in touch just at the very beginning of the show. Her name is Jill. And I just want to read this to set it up. She says, good morning. I had a breast reduction 6 months ago, going from a J to a double D cup. I'm 63. And I thought about it for a decade. My breasts became bigger after children and breastfeeding. And no matter how much I tried fitness and weight loss, they just seemed to get bigger. Eventually, it was more psychological than physical. I felt miserable, looked overweight, struggled to find the right clothes. So I paid for the surgery with the recommended surgeon. I did have some complications, hematoma and infection. But despite this, I'm now reaping the benefits, loving my new size, also feeling lighter by 5 pounds off my chest and trying new clothes. It's been life changing for me. Jill, thanks so much for getting in touch. 84844. Let me turn to you, Jackie, and welcome.
Thank you.
I watched your documentary. I loved it. I loved meeting your family in it. You're a pastor's daughter, which comes up pretty early in it because we're looking at these photographs. Tell our listeners what your relationship was like with your body as you developed breasts, as many of my listeners are telling me, almost overnight.
Sure. So I woke up one summer when I was 11 years old and I literally had double F chest and my life changed overnight. I was a child and I became a woman. I was sexualized.
In certain people's eyes.
Yes, yes. So I was sexualized from a really early age. So everything from walking to school, I remember men walking past me, they're licking their lips. I remember being in school and boys would be laughing at me every time I was running. They'd be like, look at her boobs. They'd be pinging my bra straps. I remember being told by friends and family, you need to dress more modest, you need to dress more proper. And I'm like, what does that even mean? Like, I'm a young girl. I'm trying to just dress like how my friends dress. But then I started to realize that I was being treated differently because of my chest. And it almost felt like I had to hide because I was making people feel uncomfortable.
I felt so much for that girl who was 11, 12, 13, yes. Because you, in every photograph that you showed, you had your hands, yes, kind of trying to cover your,
yes,
breasts.
Yeah, yeah. That was the norm for me, the norm for Rochelle, who was in the documentary, because you just want to hide. You want to be invisible because everybody makes you feel like your body is wrong. There's something wrong with you. You're making people feel uncomfortable. So the only thing you know how to do is just hide.
Let's talk about Rochelle.
Yeah, she was
going for breast reduction.
She was going for breast reduction, yeah. So she had never experienced a girl's night out. She didn't even really go out with her boyfriend. In fact, they would go to the cinema because it was just in the dark, so no one would see them. They would barely go out for couples dinner. She had barely any friends. And she knew that it was because having big boobs made her feel super alienated. She felt really ashamed about her body. And she talked about it in the documentary about a man following her when she was in Disney World, which is absolutely crazy. And she was a young girl. So having a breast reduction surgery for her was life changing because she was able to live life on her terms and just feel normal. That's all she ever wanted, was to feel normal and not hide anymore. And she's thriving and she's living her life. And that's just proof how life-changing breast reduction surgery is for many women.
And the other aspect that you get into, Jackie, we're in the backlog, shall we say, after COVID and, of course, cuts in hospitals, etc. Elective surgeries have gone way down the list. So a lot of people aren't getting on the NHS because the wait is too long, mm-hmm. and they're trying to pony up for themselves to the tune of £9,000.
Yeah, I mean, I think everybody's, you know, suffering one way or the other because of the NHS waiting list. And I think breast reduction surgery is free on the NHS, but it really is luck of the draw. Some people get it, some people don't. And lots of women, unfortunately, are having to resort to crowdfunders to get their breast reduction surgeries because they don't have the capital on their own. So they have to go out there and ask people to help them. And that just shows how hard it is. I mean, I can't even imagine what it's like for someone to have to start a crowdfunder. You've probably got a really normal job. You probably have a really normal life. And that's, you know, that's out there for the public, for everyone to see. And you've got to show pictures of how bad it is, you know.
And there's one lady you meet yes. who went to crowdfund and of, you know, we could have probably predicted it.
Yeah.
Got so many disgusting people getting in touch with her in a sexual way.
Yeah.
When she talked about like they wanted to photographs of her breasts yes. if they were going to fund her. I mean, boggles the mind. But, you know, listening to this is Sarah, who, you know, looks at, I suppose, the cultural place of breasts in our history. And how would you see big breasts, Sarah? I mean, Jackie and I were speaking before we came on air, and we said, like, in British culture, they're often considered...
They're funny.
Funny.
Yeah.
Yeah, there is like there is this kind of comic history of the big bust. You mentioned Barbara Windsor in the Carry On films, Hattie Jacks in there playing the sort of the matron character, and this idea of this sort of big, you know, this vast prow that's kind of both enormously sexual but sort of so intimidating that it can't be even be taken seriously. There's a very sort of weird schoolboyish attitude towards large breasts. And it's not, you know, it is not by any means unique to British culture, but in this culture it's really tied up with the sort of saucy seaside postcard tradition, and page three especially. And page three I think is really indicative of the way that very young girls, you know, girls aged sort of 15 or younger would be talent spotted for page three when that was still a thing. And having big breasts marked them as sexual even though they were still children. And there is this cultural attitude that by having big breasts you somehow entered the realm of the sort of sexually available.
But you would think, moving on from the 80s, maybe of the heyday of page three girls, that the attitudes or indeed the actions of society towards women with big breasts would have changed. But has it, Sarah?
Well, I mean, not at all, because I think as, you know, in some ways we've become less tolerant sexually of sort of pornographic content like page three being part of mainstream media. At the same time, actual pornography is absolutely rampant. I know Women's Era has done loads of really strong items about the prevalence of sexual harassment via pornography being available in schools. So that is how girls see breasts being represented primarily as sexual objects for male exploitation and use. And the bigger the breasts, the more exploitable they are, essentially, and the more you're seen to exist for men's pleasure.
Mm. Yeah, I'm just nodding my head like, yes, 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 because I do think that big breasts are seen as public property. People feel that, oh, they're out there, so they're available. Let's have a feel. Let's have a say. It almost feels like your boobs do not belong to you, but for everyone else. Like they're there for everyone else to look at and gawk at and make comments about. And I think that's one of the most incredibly hard things about having big breasts is the kind of psychological warfare that goes on in your mind. Do I own it or do I hide? You know, that is the constant battle of being proud of your own body.
That you can't have them out there. And I loved that so many of the women with big breasts
yeah.
in your documentary wore low-cut yes. tops and very much, you know, wore them proudly.
Mm.
But the fear, I suppose, if you do that, that somehow...
Yeah, if something happens to you, it's your fault. Well, why'd you have them out then? You know, it's always the blame always lies with us. Even if you don't have your boob showing, someone's still going to look. yes. someone's still going to comment.
Oh, yeah. There was one woman who, there was a man, like, she's in an office behind a glass screen, and he was coming up, and others, not just one, might I add, coming up and being lewd, basically, through that glass. Let's read some of the comments coming in. Let me see. Regarding large breasts, the cost of buying bras that fit is a challenge. There isn't enough choice of colours for women needing larger sizes. Oh my goodness, here's one. I just had to pull over when driving, hearing this on Woman's Hour. I'm having breast reduction surgery tomorrow. Wow. I'm 57 years old and I've dreamt about this for 30 years. I'm a successful businesswoman in my own right, but I'm sick of being judged by my breasts. Another, my 17-year-old daughter has big boobs like me. She feels very self-conscious about them due to the unwanted attention from older, leery men. She's learned the retaliatory death stare and form of words to call out gulping stares. I'm hoping that as she gets older, she'll get to love her double D's. And so many of these stories continue. And it is not, you are very much a body positivity and you are very much wanting to have people be proud of whatever shape and size that they are. But you did meet a lot of women that were looking for breast reduction surgery, as we're hearing from our listeners as well. I want to play an interaction you had with what the surgeon that was doing Rochelle's surgery, who does mainly breast reductions. Let's listen to the interaction.
Don't you get any problems like with your breasts, like backache, neckache?
I don't. They do feel heavy, right. Of course, but I'm almost... like so used to it.
You're used to it now, yes, okay.
And but I do have like grooves in my shoulders from the bras, okay. Things like that. Or sometimes I wear bikinis and then they just like ping off and I'm like, oh my gosh. Like
Don't forget that as you grow older, they will get worse, these problems. Okay.
What gets worse?
The digs and the hygiene of the breast and you will get backache at some point.
So I was quite moved watching you. After that, tell our listeners how that made you feel.
Yeah, I hadn't felt that triggered since I was probably 11 years old. I am someone who's, you know, really positive. And in that moment, I felt like my whole kind of self-love regarding my boobs crumbled because I was thinking, oh, God, if I'm going to have backache, then what am I doing? What am I embracing if this is going to lead me to further harm? And I felt so sad in that moment, like maybe it's wrong for me to have big boobs. But then I kind of snapped out of it a few days later and I realised that, no one can make you feel inferior without your consent, but also that I don't feel bad about my boobs. And sometimes people will make you feel that way. And it's actually separating myself from the noise and realising I'm actually okay with who I am. And I'm embracing that. So, but in that moment, he really caught me off guard. And, you know, that was a moment where I thought to myself, maybe I should consider breast reduction surgery, but.
And he is a breast reduction surgeon.
Exactly. It's sales. So he got me. Well, he thought he got me, but...
And for some people, it's wonderful. And for other people, they do not want it. So it's just... I'm just really interested in hearing people's stories on how this is. I had a reduction in my 20s, says another. It changed my life, but I'm still emotionally scarred by the attention I got before the surgery. Mm. I'm not small now. It's still tough. Sarah, just as we finish this, are you surprised at the amount of women that are in their 50s and 60s that we're hearing that are having breast reduction surgery after, you know, going through a lifetime of enduring the cultural, societal, I suppose, comments that come with having big breasts?
No, not surprised at all. And it does make sense. You know, like breasts do get larger after menopause. They do get bigger in some cases if you've been breastfeeding. Like it is likely to be something that becomes more of a problem as you get old. What does make me sad, though, is like that scene, watching Jackie receive the hard sell from the private surgeon, I found really upsetting. And that is how private medicine works. And I do think there's a trade-off that women are making to have smaller breasts. You do potentially lose sensation. You are sacrificing a part of your body to fit into what other people think you should be. And I don't think there's any way not to see that as slightly sad, actually, in some cases.
I want to thank everybody getting in touch. Keep them coming. Oh, another one's talking about her aunt who had the surgery at 81.
Whoa.
I know. So many. 84844. I'll keep reading them. Jackie Adedeji, thank you so much. Mm-hmm. And her Channel 4 documentary is called My Big Boobs. I totally recommend a watch. And we had Sarah Dightum as well on the cultural history. Thanks to you both so much. If you missed yesterday's show, You can catch up on BBC Sounds. But we had this special programme all about the lies we tell in our personal lives, from little white lies to catastrophic whoppers. And we found out why we lie and the impact that our lives can have. Relationship coach Natalie Liu explains how a lie impacted her.
I found out that my father had conceived another child behind my stepmother's back. She won't mind me saying it. He passed away anyway 6 years ago. I was mid-20s when I found out. It devastated me when I found out. I'm glad that I know the truth, but it's taken us years to process that. And it was such an unsettling for, like, it had a ripple effect, this lie, this deceit. So it does, it has a profound effect on you afterwards. It takes a long time to trust yourself again, but also you struggle to trust others.
Terrific guests. You can listen back to the programme by going to BBC Sounds. Now, we've talked a lot about childcare costs on this programme. How's this for a conundrum? Getting into debt in order to go to work because the cost of childcare is throwing you into the red as you're trying to maintain a career. According to the Discrimination Against Mothers campaign group, it's called Pregnant and Screwed, one in three parents using formal childcare have had to rely on some sort of debt to cover childcare costs, and nearly half of those were single parents. There's a survey of 2,000 working mothers last year. It found that almost half had debts of more than £5,000. Now, you might know, we've talked about this before, childcare costs in the UK are the third highest in the world. That's according to data from the OECD. So it's leaving many women with this age-old choice, career or motherhood. Is it worth, for example, taking out a loan, using credit cards to pay for that childcare while you try to continue on a career trajectory? Or is it too much of a financial risk? Well, I'm joined now by two mothers with different experiences of taking that path. Tanaka Choto is a single mother with a five-year-old son working in financial services in London. And we also have Ellie Turner, a professional musician and teacher, also single with children aged 20, 11 and almost two, based in Lincolnshire. Tanaka, let me start with you. What was the situation when you were having your son? What were you thinking about childcare costs if you were?
Yes, so I was suffering from a relationship breakdown at that time, and I was moving out and trying to, you know, establish myself somewhere and get some furniture in the house. And it was a big thought because I was just at the beginning of my career in finance. I was on a graduate scheme and it's quite difficult to get. So I had to think about what I wanted to do. So I ended up taking a £10,000 loan to pay off the childcare. And I mean, it sounds like a lot and it is a lot, but it wasn't even really a dent to the overall cost that I had to pay, because in the first year I had to pay £1,200 a month, which ended up being more than £14,000 a year. And then in the preceding months, when he did qualify for 30 hours free childcare, I was paying around £800 a month. So in total, over those 4 years, because he's a September baby, so I had an extra year of childcare to account for, I ended up paying around £45,000 to have him continue and go to nursery.
And was it a very clear career and financial plan that this will pay for itself? I'm almost thinking like some people might think about university, for example.
Yes, it was a lot like that, because I think we do need to just take a step back and reassess and look at childcare for what it is. It's education, it's early years education. So we have a situation in this country where up to 18 you get completely free funded by the government cost, and then after you finish school you can go to university and you get a student loan and a student grant, because we recognise that the cost is so significant that if we don't offer that, we'll end up with a country where we won't have doctors, we won't have nurses, we won't have the educational underpinning that we need, and then look to migration. And this, the same is actually similar for parents. We're being asked basically because it's unaffordable. I mean, when I started discussing about this on a public level, like in 2021, at the end of 2021, 80% of parents said it was unaffordable for them. And now it's gone to 94% of parents saying it's unaffordable. So I get a lot of those responses, which are like, well, if you can't afford kids, don't have them, but that means 94% mm-hmm. of kids would not be here, and we will have to look to migration again.
And this seems to also be, of course, there can be lots of men involved in this, but it can be primarily a woman's issue if they are the primary caregivers. Ellie, you're a professional harpist, so can be less financially stable a career, I'd imagine, than financial services. You do have three children that I mentioned. Tanaka was telling us about the 45,000. How about your debt, if you're okay talking about it?
Yeah, fine. It seems to be that I've racked up around 30,000 in debt. It's not all through childcare, but a huge amount of that is, because I haven't really had much help with that. And a big problem for me is that I'm using babysitters who are out of hours childcare. So as well as it being an educational thing, in my case, it's also really a nurturing thing. I've needed wonderful caregivers who've had my children, you know, even had to put my children to bed while I've done concerts. So I've been using people who are really in loco parentis, and that those the kind of money that I've been paying people is normally in cash. And it can be a lot higher because they might just have one of my children. So it's quite a substantial cost and you can't get that back. You can't offset that against tax or universal credit.
You know, Tanaka was kind of talking about it as a career plan. Is that the way you thought about it too? That perhaps as a harpist, you might be coming to a point where your salary would increase?
Definitely. I always thought that I was on a kind of upward career trajectory.
Yes.
And I also was aware that I had, you know, a gift to a certain extent, and that I felt that I had a responsibility to use that. My parents invested heavily in my musical education. Mm-hmm. And so it was a passion, but it also felt like a responsibility. Mm-hmm. And I've always loved working in the community and using my music in lots of different situations, you know, to do with caregiving and so on, not just concerts. So I felt like I had this really strong vocation and passion for what I was doing. But I did constantly have to justify my choices to myself and to a certain extent to other people, certainly to my own parents. A refrain from my own mother, "Eleanor, you need to change your life." Constantly, "Eleanor, you need to change your life. This is unsustainable." And I think I just felt the fear of failure to a certain extent, and that kind of shame, and knowing what I'd invested up to that point, then not wanting to lose that, you know, really finding it very difficult to look at it rationally and see how much money I was losing.
So you were pretty far down that path, but I know a couple of your children are older now. You still have a little one that's just about two, so obviously you're facing it again. But do you regret doing it the way you did, in the sense of taking on that debt?
It's really difficult to answer that, because I think now I can see that there would be... I haven't gained that much by doing it. And a lot of the attempts that I made to invest in something that I saw as more secure for my children, because, you know, we do it all for our children, really... they were actually career failures. And so things like working within the daytime whilst my children were at school or nursery, I tried to kind of mould my career in that direction. Yes. For a long time. And actually something to do with my instrument, the harp, being a very niche instrument, lots of my plans kind of just, they didn't come through in the way that I hoped they would. I thought I was getting, working in schools and universities, I thought, you know, I was getting little things like pension schemes and things that I wouldn't have otherwise been able to afford myself. So I was really trying, but usually it didn't come out well. So I ended up losing more in the long run.
It sounds to me, what you're saying, Ellie, is that you were really still trying to fit, and the harp is a big instrument, but to fit it around raising children instead of being able to go 100% the road of a musician, which is a very obviously strange hours, maybe on the road, all those sort of things that mightn't fit exactly with trying to care for those children in the way that you wanted to. Tanaka, you were hearing the story there. I know you were nodding as well to some of what Ellie was saying. But do you have any advice to mums out there? Because it can pay off or not pay off, as we're hearing, when it comes to actually financial security.
I mean, most of life is just a lot of risk taking. Take a step back. I'm not here to advocate for people to get in debt, obviously. I had just completed my master's. I was on a graduate scheme with a very set, clear progression path. And I took that was the right decision for me. And for me, it has worked and it has blossomed. And, you know, I keep rising within my career field. The only thing that I have to say is that I don't think the government thinks about single parents, really, because let's say I end up, you know, climbing to the top. Maybe I'm earning £80,000. What I take home will be less than two parent home that will bring in 40K in because of the tax rates. And I don't think that's fair at all.
I understand. Well, thank you both so much for coming on, Tanaka Choko. And also we had Ellie joining us. Different roads that they took when it came to paying for childcare. I just want to read a statement from the Department for Education. They say, we're introducing the largest ever expansion of free childcare in England, worth up to an average of £6,500 per child per year for a working family. We recognise the cost pressures that childcare can create for parents, and low-income families already qualify for 15 hours free childcare for two-year-olds a year before all children become eligible for 15 hours at age 3 and 4. We're also increasing the childcare costs that parents on universal credit can claim back by around 50%. It's something we'll keep talking about, an election issue, many say. Right, let me move on to something else. Will you miss the sound of this? Yep, Sky Atlantic HBO TV series Succession. Of course, it has ended after four dramatic seasons, called the greatest TV show ever made. Agree? It's satirical. It's a dark comedy. It's a drama. It's about power and politics and a family dynasty, and follows the highly dysfunctional and fictional Roy family, who control the biggest media and entertainment company in the world. I'm going to try and avoid spoilers, but listen, if you haven't seen the big one, it's going to come up of this last series. So tune out for the next 10 minutes if you have to, and join me tomorrow. But the reason we wanted to talk about it today is that the show has produced incredible female characters. And we have here to talk us through the comedian Sarah Barron, you're very welcome, who co-hosts Firecrotch and Normcore podcast, all about the show, and journalist Laura Martin, both staying up to watch the finale live, as did I. So I think I have to jump into Shiv straight away. This is Siobhan, one of the daughters of Logan Roy, running for Succession. For me, she was one of the most compelling characters that I watched. For you, Laura, is she also... who was it? What person or what woman was it that grabbed you?
Oh, totally Shiv. It's just so interesting that people are like, oh, are you Team Shiv or Team Kendall, Team Roman?
They're the other two sons, yes?
Yes, but the ultimate thing is they're all awful people. It's, you know, she sets herself up as, you know, she's so smart, she's intelligent, she's fierce, but she gives as good as she gets, but it all kind of comes crumbling down because she will trample over anyone to get what she wants. Yes, yeah, so that's kind of, it's a double-edged sword with Shiv, I think.
What about that, Sarah, though? I thought she was kind of a new type of female TV character, did you?
In as much as sort of she was allowed to be despicable and sort of morally disgusting, but then also touch our hearts. I thought that combination was part of what made her so unique. And she also took me on this very disturbing but really compelling journey, which I feel is part of what Succession does at every turn, in terms of making me look at my own sort of internalized misogyny, because I spent all of the first three seasons kind of hating her and then hating myself for hating one of the primary female characters. And then so much of season four is about exploring on an even deeper level why she does what she does, and then feeling, I would say, more sympathy for her than almost anyone else in the show.
She does talk at her father's funeral, spoiler alert, that he could not fit a whole woman in his head, but he definitely had loads of women around him. We see the current wife and the mistress and the former wives and mistresses all sitting together, even taking each other's hands. What did you think about that scene?
I thought that was so touching, especially because in one of the earlier episodes, you'd seen Marcia, who was his wife, latest wife, absolutely bawling out Kerry, the mistress, sending her home shame to her small apartment. But in the funeral scene, it was very touching. She took her hand. I love that line where they said, well, you know, at least he won't be grinding his teeth tonight. The only four women, so the two ex-wives and the two mistresses, mistresses that would have truly known what Logan was like. But I think that was very interesting, that line of how he couldn't fit a whole woman in his head. It's why for Shiv, she was never really going to be the chosen one to be the successor, because he actually couldn't handle the idea of a woman doing it, I think, ultimately.
And at the end, she does this twist. Does she stay with the brothers, or does she go to Tom, her husband, to try, I think, this is my interpretation, to maintain power?
Well, this is the thing about Shiv. She claims to be altruistic, but it's all to work in her own favour. It wasn't that she wanted to help out Tom, that she was thinking of her future child. It was just she didn't want Kendall to have it. That's what it came down to.
I kind of thought of a name. You only get to choose your husband's at times, or your father's, and that kind of came to my mind as I saw that scene. But let me go back to you, Sarah, as well. We cannot forget Jerry, the general counsel and interim CEO of the company, who did have an affair with a much younger man, the son, Roman. How did you see her role in this last series?
Well, first of all, we have to remember she did not have an affair with him. She was sort of, you know, she was sent all these pics by him and all this, you know, all this sort of, what even was it? Sexual chemistry, kind of something like that. But I think, flirting. You know, that I say that again.
Flirting? I don't know.
What do we sort of, it sort of is harassment, you know, as is the case with Succession, all these fascinating and bizarre power dynamics kind of came into play with that situation. But I thought that the story of that actor, J. Smith Cameron, is a really interesting one, because the role of Jerry in any other show would have been someone that you kind of almost couldn't remember the name of the guy. It was supposed to be a man initially, but then J. Smith Cameron came in and read for it, as I understand it, and was so compelling in how she presented that they made that a woman instead, and she's gone on to become the sort of fan favorite. Which I think is an interesting point about Succession more generally, is that we're talking about the women of it. And it's not even just as simple as these fabulous female characters, like the writer's room and the directors and the executive producers and the people doing the costumes and the people getting the props together. There are so many women involved in every facet of that show, which I think has helped to make it a rounder, bigger, more detailed thing than it would otherwise be.
And there's more than we have spoken about. But Sarah Barron, thank you so much. Firecrush, Norm Corus, where you find her, and Laura Martin, the journalist, thank you both for talking to us about Succession. Tomorrow, trampolining. That's all for today's Woman's Hour. Join us again next time.
Hello, it's me, Jade Adams, and I'm back with a second series of Welcome to the Neighbourhood. This is the Radio 4 podcast, where myself and a celebrity guest like to have a nosy round social media groups from up and down the country.
Bit of a strange one, but I am looking to get rid of a second-hand coffin.
My mum has found this little metal box in her garden. Can anybody local please remove 3 stitches out of my neck?
This series, I'm joined by some top people, including Nick Grimshaw.
It's a grenade!
Izzy Sutty.
That's my favourite reply.
And self-esteem.
If you think I should cover this one up, you should see my other one. Bloody hell.
Head to BBC Sounds to find brand new episodes of Welcome to the Neighbourhood with me, Jade Adams.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.